You are listening to Scotland's Ear to the Ground, the podcast that brings you interviews with Scotland's finest composers.
Your hosts are Aileen Sweeney and Ben Eames.
You're listening to is by Timothy Cooper. A composer and performer of electroacoustic music. Tim's work is often collaborative, working with musicians, artists, and poets, amongst others. Since 2019, Tim has been working with Ensemble 1604, composing a concert-length show called Shadows That in Darkness Dwell. This explores the music and the life of English Renaissance composer John Dowland, which we're going to hear more about today. So how's it going, Tim?
Yeah, good, thanks. And you guys?
Good. All right.
Yeah.
Can't complain. The album's a huge deep dive on John Dowland. So where did that all come from?
So I really liked early music as a teenager, and I was a brass player, predominantly a euphonium player, and yes, you play early music on brass instruments for sure, but it wasn't a huge part of what I was doing as a euphonium player, and I wanted to play that music, so I started taking recorder lessons.
Really?
Yeah. So there was a really, really amazing local teacher called Jane Mitchell, who is probably, in terms of teaching, the best one-to-one music teacher I ever had. Like, she identified problems that I had so precisely. She was just born to be a teacher. Not to say that my euphonium teachers weren't amazing as well, but Jane really got teaching, and she really got me. And she was running a kind of day or weekend of recorder, what was it called, the Northern Recorder Days or something. And one of the teachers in their class was doing Jacob van Eyck, who was a Dutch composer who was blind and a recorder player. He wrote a book called Der Flötenlusthof, which means The Flute's Garden of Delights, which is such a charming title. And in Der Flötenlusthof, one of the pieces that we looked at was his variations on the Pavane Lacrimae, which is the other name for Flow My Tears. And so I was learning that in my lessons with Jane, and that piece really stuck with me for a few reasons. But one of the reasons it stuck with me was Jane wrote the words of the song over the melody notes. And we talked a lot about how to shape the music according to the text, which as a non-singer, I'd never really thought about, especially playing a wind instrument. It wasn't something where I'd gone, oh yeah, I should shape this music according to the text, because usually there isn't text. And it was probably the text that stuck with me, like the kind of haunting, slightly strange, surreal text that, or at least to, I suppose, contemporary ears, you know, quite strange words, strange phrasings. It's kind of ephemeral. It feels like there's a kind of meaning behind it, but I can't quite hold on to it. I know it's kind of sad and it's mournful, but some of the references you don't quite get, but they're really, really beautiful. And so that's literally the starting point for Dowland. Was I played some stuff on the recorder and it stuck with me, but I knew that as I was hoping to make a kind of much bigger project, I wanted to dig more into his life. So read, you know, the odd biography and stuff, and Diana Poulton's book about Dowland, which was the first kind of biography about Dowland, was really, really interesting, because Dowland wrote loads of letters and there's loads about Dowland, more than maybe some of his contemporaries, but there being more stuff almost makes it more mysterious because he contradicts himself so often. And so it's like, well, what's the truth? And it's not really clear where he was born, maybe what his nationality was. He went and worked in Denmark for a long time, and the assumption is that he was kind of out of favour in the English court, and he was out of favour at a time where it was really bad news if you were Catholic. So maybe was he Catholic, but there's not as much evidence as, say, like William Byrd. It's really obvious that William Byrd was Catholic, but with Dowland, it's not so clear. So this kind of felt like he became more and more mysterious as I worked more and more on it. But there's loads of text about and by Dowland that became part of the whole project. So he was mentioned in a kind of polemical treatise about Renaissance life by this guy called William Prynne, who was basically like super pious and believed that the only way to heaven was through like being ultra devout and having no fun. It was basically a denunciation of everything that was considered fun in Renaissance England, like dancing, music, the theatre. He said, if you do any of that, you're going straight to hell. And there's this lovely bit of text where he wrote, alas, there are few that find the narrow way. And those few, what are they? Not dancers, but mourners. Not laughers, but weepers. Whose tune is lacrimae. Whose music sighs for sin. Who know no other cinque pace but this to heaven. And so lacrimae, that's a direct reference to Dowland. He was really associated with that melody that he composed. And cinque pace, that means five-step dance, kind of loosely Galliard, but there are other kind of five-step dances. And so that was one of the basis of one of the pieces called The Narrow Way. It was kind of all of it. Basically, it became a kind of riposte to William Prynne. It's like, no, dancing good. Laughing good, music good, theatre good is kind of the message of that piece.
Alas, there are few that find the narrow way. So the next few weeks are pretty exciting for you. The music that you've been working on with Ensemble 1604 over the past few years is soon to be released as an album, along with a performance at the Night With's first ever festival. So can you tell us a wee bit about the project?
So I guess it all started with the Night With, in that I was talking to Matthew about an idea for a piece, and he said, send me 100 words. And then he said, do you want me to commission it? Which was really kind. It was a really kind of easy way in. And basically the idea was to develop a piece that I wrote in 2011 that was also called Shadows in Darkness Dwell, which is probably really complicated for my PRS, you know, which version of the piece is it? Anyway, that was for the National Centre for Early Music's composition competition that they run with the BBC, and my piece got workshopped, and I had a sense that there was some really good material in the piece, but also that the piece wasn't that good as a kind of whole. And it had always kind of stuck in my mind that I wanted to do something with that material. And I was getting about halfway through my PhD, and I wasn't quite sure what the next thing was. And I started thinking about that material again and thinking about what I wanted to do with it. So the original piece was for viol consort. But I decided I wanted to work with a mixed ensemble, partly because I'd kind of had a really long-standing belief that mixed ensembles plus electronics were like inevitably doomed to failure, because it's hard enough to kind of make a coherent piece with one type of sound. So if you make a piece using clarinet-like sounds, then it might make sense to only have clarinets in that piece. So finding a way to make sense out of the combination of different kinds of instrumental colours and electronics was like the kind of starting point for the piece. And yeah, that's kind of where it started. And then over the last 4 or so years, I've been working with Alex, Lucia, Laszlo and Rory, who are my colleagues in Ensemble 1604, looking at new pieces or other pieces that explore the life and music of Dowland. So some of them really continue to explore the music. And that's, I guess, where Shadows started. It started with Dowland's probably most famous piece, Flow My Tears. And then the other pieces either look at aspects of his life or interests from Renaissance England around the time that Dowland was alive, or other aspects of his music. And yeah, that's kind of where the project all came from.
Brilliant.
So you've mentioned your piece, Shadows That in Darkness Dwell. Could you talk us through the different sections and highlight any particular points of interest?
So I think one of the things with this piece is the kind of overall concepts behind it are kind of some of the more interesting things. So one of the starting points was the combination of different instruments and electronics and finding a way to do that in a kind of interesting way. And one of the things that I thought about at the start was trying to create the sense that each performer had their own shadow or kind of counterpart. At the start of the process, I thought of them a little bit like the demons in Philip Pullman's Dark Materials, those kind of other parts of your soul that live outside the body. And the players are asked to listen really closely to their counterpart and to interact with it in terms of the kind of shape, timbre, spatial kind of feeling of the material. And they're also asked to listen to each other and each other's electroacoustic counterpart. And so the whole kind of experience of the piece for the players becomes about kind of really closely listening to each other and the electroacoustic part. And that was the kind of way in I found for trying to make a piece that used a mixed ensemble plus electronics. Each of the movements has its own title, Flow, Fled and Darkness. And the idea in each movement is to take that word, which comes from Dowland's Flow My Tears, and to really explore a meaning of that word. So in Flow, it's kind of really literally trying to be kind of overflowing in the way that the music unfolds. So Fled starts with a kind of sense of propulsion. One of the things I think a lot about in the way that I make electroacoustic music is like a sense of energy and what that energy is. And Fled is like really about moving forwards. One of the things I really enjoyed exploring with the ensemble in this section was improvisatory material based on little fragments of Dowland, but with kind of quite in specific instructions for like how that material should be performed. So asking them to do like spitty things or aggressive things. And what I think was interesting about that was that it kind of plays or uses their experience as improvisers as well as performers of early music. And I really wanted the music to kind of feel familiar for them. And this was one way that I tried to do that. So Darkness kind of does what it says on the tin. What I wanted to do with this section was create a kind of real sense of being in a almost tangible space, but not one that you would kind of recognize. So you've got a sense of like the kind of proportions of the room that you might be listening to, and a sense of, you know, there are kind of boundaries to the space, but they're quite a long way away. And the lights are probably off in this kind of room. First thing I did with the players was I worked with them all individually, and they recorded materials based on Dowland. So I took in like a kind of page of stuff and then said, can you play this line, but in this way? Okay, let's do the same line, but in this way, do this line, but in this way. And I think what I'd asked Laszlo to do when he performed this material was to play it so decoratively, it became kind of not stylistic. It's more than you would normally do to Dowland, but then actually when it was adopted into the piece, it doesn't feel like more than you would do with Dowland. It just feels like a kind of extension of it.
Some of the tracks have very unique fixed media parts that accompany the musicians. Can you tell us how you created the tape part and in turn integrated it into the piece?
Yeah, so each piece is kind of different in a sense. One of the threads is that there were sounds that are drawn from the instruments themselves that were made in various recording sessions. So Shadows uses pretty much only sounds related to the instruments, as far as I can remember. And they were all made in kind of initial recording sessions before we made that piece. And they were based on material that was related to Dowland in terms of the way it's played, in terms of the way they shape it. So that piece has a kind of really instrumental kind of feel to it in terms of the electronics. The narrow way, the starting point, I suppose, for that was actually more the electroacoustic part than the instruments. So the electroacoustic part was almost finished before I even thought about adding the instruments, which is not something I would often recommend. But what I wanted to do in the show and across the album was to have a kind of balance of kind of power. So in Shadows, it feels like the instruments are like the focal point. In the narrow way, the electroacoustic part is much more the focal point. And then the live performance of the instruments kind of gives it a bump every now and then. It's like, it just encourages the electroacoustic part on its way, or at least that was the kind of idea. And so that piece, I was much freer in the way that I use sounds. One of the things in that piece that is there that I don't think anyone would recognize, but might find kind of fun, is that in that piece, there's also text from Genesis, and there's one line where Adam and Eve get sent out of the garden, and they get, you know, they get told they're going to till the ground from whence they were taken. And so tilling is obviously a bit like raking. So in our garage at home, we have this big sheet metal roof that's really resonant. So I got a rake and scraped it on the ceiling and kind of really close mic'd that. And a lot of the kind of sounds that you'd go, I have no idea what that is, but it sounds big and it sounds dramatic. That's my rake on the ceiling of my garage. I think the other thing that I did in the narrow way was I just pushed material that I'd recorded before a lot further and transformed it kind of harder and made it more abstracted. So there's stuff that was probably recorded for Shadows that didn't quite make it into that piece, but then found a new home in a different way. Labyrinth, I think, is also kind of fun because half of the material for that piece, for the electroacoustic part, was recorded in the crypt at Glasgow Cathedral. And I wanted to explore recording source material not in a dry studio. Like, standard practice if you're recording instruments for an electroacoustic part is to like get as controlled a sound as you can in the studio. But what I wanted to do was see how Lucia played differently in the crypt, what felt different, what sounded different. One of the interesting things was thinking about how the conversations went in those different spaces. In the studio, it tends to become a little bit like kind of technical and like, oh, I didn't play that note right, or I didn't do that right. Whereas in the crypt, we talked about music, which was really interesting. We talked more about the kind of overall shape, the feel, the kind of vibe of the material, rather than kind of micromanaging, like, oh, have you got a version where it sounds right? And I guess by that point, Lucia trusted that the sounds were going to be transformed, and also that I was not going to choose versions that represented her badly as a player. So I think there was that kind of level of trust to kind of really go somewhere with the material. That was really fun. And so we did all these kind of strange extended techniques in the crypt late at night. And, you know, I think that did probably change the way that that recording session went in maybe some quite unknowable ways. And then, yeah, for me, writing electroacoustic music is kind of a process-based thing, at least to begin with. I get the sounds that I've recorded, usually edit them into small pieces that are then kind of manageable to work with, then make kind of families of sounds. So if I transform one version of a sound in one way, I'll probably do it to all of the versions. So if I've got, you know, 10 gestures that have the same kind of sound quality, but they have a slightly different kind of shapes and kind of details, then they would all get the same processing as I'm going through, which is kind of laborious, but it means that you get these kind of pools of sounds that kind of gradually build until the point where you start to, or I start to drag them into the kind of edit or arrange window in the software that I'm using. And I press play and I go, I didn't like that, so I'll try another 10 sounds. Press play, no, I didn't like that, so I'll try another 10 sounds. Press play, oh, I quite liked that, but I didn't like this about it. And then I try and find out what I didn't like about it, and then I'm composing.
So how did you approach choosing when the music explored more experimental contemporary sounds and when you brought the period instruments back into their sort of natural habitats?
Yeah, so again, this is one of those things that is kind of different in each piece and kind of considered as a kind of like whole set. So in Shadows, everything kind of subsides into the downland, whereas in The Narrow Way, it's much more jagged, like the instruments kind of do really dramatic things just before the downland happens. It was, I mean, mostly a kind of intuitive thing. So with The Narrow Way, at one point, I was really unsure what to do with a certain section. So I pinched a viol recording of some galliards and just dropped it in. It was like, oh, that works. And I'm not sure why, but it really works. And so there's this sense of these different relationships with and to Dowland in the different pieces. So in The Narrow Way, Dowland almost feels like a kind of other, like his music feels like it's kind of other, but then it kind of gradually grows in and dominates the piece by the end, because it's got this like full quotation of a Dowland galliard at the end of that piece. I would claim that's part of my piece, but it also is absolutely not part of my piece. I did not write a single note, but the whole piece is a kind of preparation for this really long statement. Mm. And so that's how that kind of works in The Narrow Way. And then in Labyrinth, the other place that it really happens, it's almost like it kind of falls into it. And Lucia is doing these really complex, kind of crazy gestures that sound really dramatic, but actually are just extensions of the way the baroque bow moves. So the baroque bow, if you play a down bow, there will naturally be a diminuendo. If you play an up bow, there will naturally be a crescendo, as opposed to the modern bow, which was designed to create a totally even sound. So up bow, down bow sounds in theory exactly the same. That's never quite true. But with the baroque bow, what I wanted to really celebrate was that, what it did. And so there are these gestures that look really, really fussy on the page, but really what it is Lucia does a really strong down bow, then tremolo at the tip, and then a really strong up bow. And it's different ways of kind of combining those kind of three components in a kind of really improvisatory way. And so they combine with this really dramatic electroacoustic music, and then suddenly we're into Dowland. There's a kind of big swell in the electroacoustic part, and suddenly Lucia is playing something that sounds much more like Dowland, and all of a sudden we're straight back out of that world, back into the kind of contemporary music. The whole disc, I guess, ends with a kind of pre-recorded quotation of Dowland's, if not most famous piece, second most famous piece. So a piece called Semper Dowland, Semper Dolens, which means always Dowland, always miserable, or always dolorous, because it was really fashionable to be melancholic. And it was like, it was the fashion. And Dowland seems to have maybe played on that as kind of part of his almost stage persona. One of my colleagues said, you know, if Dowland was alive today, he'd either be like a glam rocker or a heavy metal guitarist, like with that kind of staged persona. And I wonder whether he has a point. And so the whole of that piece, Semper Melancholia, which is a really obvious play on Semper Dowland, Semper Dolens, is kind of a build-up to this quotation. And what I hope it will feel like in the live show is like because the one pre-recorded lute will be as loud as the ensemble have just been. It'll kind of sound like a giant lute, and it's like Dowland having his kind of last say.
Dowland was around today and was living life as a metal rocker or whatever, what do you think he would think of the album?
That's a really good question.
I know.
I think, you know, a bit like Radiohead and Steve Reich, I wonder whether there might be a little bit of kind of like kindred spirits. You know, I'm another of those ex-brass playing composers who was a heavy metal fan as a kid. I think he'd think it was a kind of interesting homage. I hope.
If only we could know.
But then maybe if he was alive today, he'd be an electric acoustic composer.
Yeah, true. True.
Maybe that's the other thing he'd be.
So can you tell our listeners where and when they can get the album and when they can hear it live?
So the album is out November 24th. It's on Bandcamp for physical discs and on the Nightwith's own website for physical discs, the TNW Music website, I should say. It's also going to be on Apple Music, Spotify, Deezer. And if you want to know which other streamers it's on, then there's an .ffm to link on both mine and the Nightwith's websites, so you can choose which streamer you would prefer to consume this on. And we're playing it live at the Nightwith Festival December 15th at 8 o'clock till 9:30. So hope to see you there.
Brilliant. Perfect. Is there anything else you'd like to plug?
I mean, if anyone's really, really interested, then my PhD commentary is now published on the St Andrews repository. So if you found any of this interesting and you want to know more about the kind of process behind it, then that's there. The other thing to plug, I guess, is the amazing album artwork that my friend Susie Leeper, who's a calligrapher and painter, did. It's really worth having a look at the CD booklet, which is available with the Bandcamp download or the physical copy. Also worth just having a look at Susie's website. She's a brilliant, brilliant artist. It's susieleeper.com.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah, it looks amazing. Yeah. Oh, jinx. Oh. So to play you out, we'll hear Who's Heavenly Touch. Can you say a few words about the piece before we listen?
So Who's Heavenly Touch? Touch is the English word for toccata. So toccata literally means to touch. It's kind of about tactility. And so it was kind of a really pragmatic decision. I felt like the whole disc and the show needed something kind of fast, agile, and that didn't take itself too seriously, because the whole disc takes itself really quite seriously. And it's a really deep dive into Dowland. And then, but for this kind of 5-6 minutes, everything kind of lightens up a little bit. And so it's a kind of fast toccata. And it was in theory meant to be for recorder and theorbo, but the music fits so badly on the theorbo that we had to rework it as a trio. And I think it's probably better this way, because Alex can do, the theorbist can do kind of lute-like things around the cello in ways that I couldn't possibly have kind of conceived. And so it's another kind of place where I really owe a lot to the players, and they bring a lot of fun and joy, I think, to this piece in terms of the way they play it. So Whose Heavenly Touch is a response to a sonnet by Richard Barnfield, which is all about a couple, and one of them really loves poetry and the other really, really likes music. And it's all about how if they each love one, then they must love each other really well. But it really fleetingly refers to Dowland in the sonnet. I just really loved the idea of Dowland being so good at the lute that people wrote sonnets about how good he was at the lute. And so it goes, if music and sweet poetry agree, as they must needs the sister and the brother, then must the love be great twixt thee and me, because thou lovest the one and I the other. Dowland to thee is dear, whose heavenly touch upon the lute doth ravish human sense. Thank you.
Thank you.